This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and with us is Joseph Peet. He is a business reporter and has covered a lot of other things, too, for the Times of Northwest Indiana lately. And Joseph, thank you for being with us on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, the first story up here is the story that we're all keeping a very close eye on. It's a business and crime-related story. It's about the woman who was arrested in connection with the arsons that happened not long ago at the Walmart in Lansing, Illinois, and the Meijer store in Highland, Indiana. Well, fill us in on the latest about the arrest and what this woman's connected with.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, it's kind of a very strange, unusual series of events. There were a series of arsons inside the Lansing Walmart, closing it for several days, and the Highland Meijer, and the fires sped off the sprinklers, caused an estimated $4.5 million in damages. The Lansing Walmart ended up being closed for 3 weeks. It turned out that the fires were set as a way of distracting, the store employees and everything so they could commit shoplifting and kind of walk out and load up an SUV with items. One suspect had been caught earlier, but the police had just pretty much arrested the primary suspect. Heather D. Whedon of Ford Heights was arrested and charged in connection with the Lansing Walmart fire. No charges have been filed yet in the Indiana one, but the Lansing police, who are kind of leading a joint investigation, said she had been the primary suspect in both fires. She had actually been released on parole from prison in 2017 for a first-degree murder conviction. And her accomplice had kind of identified her, and she was convicted of murder and vehicular hijacking in 1998. She pled guilty to the carjacking after luring a man to a location in downstate Madison County, where he was fatally shot. She was released on parole in 2020. She's had previous convictions also from forgery and aggravated battery to a police officer. The police are saying the fires were quickly extinguished and no one was hurt. But it was done pretty much to conceal retail thefts. It was a joint investigation between the Highland Police, Lansing Police, and Lansing Police or Lansing Fire Department arson investigators. Jerry L. Pearson, a 35-year-old man from Chicago Heights, was charged in Lake County for the arson at the Highland Meijer on Indianapolis Boulevard, just across the street from Highland Grove. He was already in custody in Will County on an unrelated matter, and he's set to be extradited to Indiana. He had told police that his added accomplice named Six, goes by the name of Six, where they set the fires and then loaded a bunch of stolen items into the SUVs. The police had identified them via security footage at both stores. And it was finally, brought to a resolution. There were the two main suspects involved in the case, but it's they caused a lot of damage and disrupted a lot of things. Both of those stores are very highly trafficked and very busy.
Oh, yes. I can certainly believe that. I've been to that Highland Meijer store many times in my life, and it's a crazy place to be sure. And I would imagine this is one good reason why the loss prevention people at the store have to keep an eye on not only on people actually shoplifting, but now apparently people trying to start fires so they can in turn shoplift even more. So that's an interesting story that we'll just have to keep an eye on, to be sure. One of the other stories that you had out in print and online in the Times talks about the problems that famous YouTuber and internet celebrity Logan Powell ended up in. He thought he probably made a really good investment, I guess, at one time. But as those commercials that you hear on the radio about investments always warn you that there's always the possibility of risk, of loss. And that's certainly what we understand with Logan Powell. Logan Paul, will you fill us in on what Logan faced and the issue that he has gotten himself in the news about?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, he's a pretty famous, YouTuber and internet celebrity. He's got 6.2 million followers on YouTube. He is got 23.2 million followers on YouTube. Very substantial.
Wow.
That's bigger than most of the, like what networks draw, the Nielsen ratings. celebrity boxing with his brother and everything. Part of the reason this is a, or the real, the reason the tie, the reason this is a local story, is because he tweeted to all his followers a while that he dropped $3.5 million on this rare set of original Pokemon cards, and it had been authenticated by Schererville's Baseball Card Exchange, which is a very, you know, prominent local business on US 41 in Schererville.
Mm-hmm.
They have been in business since 1990. They're very well known in the local trade and collectibles market. They have a really, you know, it's a local company, but they have a national footprint, as they have, they really specialize in the trade of these vintage and open cards for, you know, not only major sports, but kind of non-sports trading things. They bought and sold millions of dollars worth of, like, vintage merchandise, and they're one of the only, if not the only company, where they do authentication of these vintage cards. However, one thing you've seen in the high-end collectibles market, whether it's art or wine or, you know, whatever it may be, it also, you know, these high prices tend to attract forgers and frauds. And then, unfortunately, it turned out that the Pokemon cards that he had bought and that were authenticated were like apparently a very sophisticated scam that was perpetrated by fraudsters. He had posted a video where it's, you know, he's posing in front of the Bean in Chicago where he's saying, this story is crazy. I lost $3.5 million on fake Pokemon cards. It was like the number one trending video on YouTube, like, you know, one of the most visited sites in the world. And it was it's really captivated the public imagination. And front and center of it is the Schererville company. He went back to Chicago after, because he posted these cards, but then a lot of these internet sleuths and Pokemon experts started kind of looking at the cards and the online evidence and determined he might have gotten ripped off based on what they had seen. And then so he went to Chicago. He met with the owner of the Schererville Baseball Card Exchange and some of the representatives, and they sat down in a hotel room to kind of verify the validity of the box. And they went through it step by step on the video.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently it turned out it was pretty sophisticated, because the Schererville company did do some pretty in-depth checks. You know, they were looking at the seal and the tape, and it had been aged onto the box and made to look like it was original. There were even like lines of the tape that had been embedded with age. This wasn't some sort of like amateur con. This was a very, like, detailed and sophisticated. They knew what would be looked for in authentication, so they went to trouble. They're still not sure how they did it exactly, but they went to a lot of trouble to make it seem like this box had, you know, been, you know, sealed years and years ago, and that this was like the real deal. But when they, you know, were opening it, which, you know, the scammer probably didn't think they were going to do, because that kind of invalidates its monetary value.
Right.
But they discovered a lot of the Pokemon card boxes were very puffy. There's nothing on there to indicate it was a first edition. A real telltale sign is that one of the boxes was stuffed with G.I. Joe trading cards, not even Pokemon. So it was real source of dismay. You know, Logan Paul in the videos were saying it's, you know, sad for all the parties involved. That for the Pokemon community raises the question of how many fraudulent items are being traded out there. You know, said he was grateful for all the real authentic things he had now. The owner of the Schererville Baseball Card Exchange has done, you know, 100,000 boxes, 500,000 packs.
Oh,
he's done, you know, he's done this for the authentication service PSA. Authenticates cards for PSA all the time. Is saying this is the first they've ever come across. I mean, it's a very sophisticated forgery where they really made it look like, you know, this, the tape, everything had been unopened for years and years. And he had never seen anything like this, but this is a very, you know, anytime you have this much money where people are spending $3.5 million on trading cards, you can expect it's going to start attracting, you know, counterfeiters. You see the forgers in the art world are copying paintings all the time, you know, trying to pass them off. They've managed to fool like these museum experts with like PhDs who studied art history. And it's just anytime you're dealing with like a multi-million dollar market with this, it's going to attract counterfeiters and frauds. And but the Steve Hart with the Baseball Card Exchange, he's expressing a lot of like you know, very troubled by this, a lot of remorse, saying it weighs on him very heavily. He's his own worst critic, and this is very tough. It's not good for anyone to see that something like this was revealed to be phony.
Well, that's what happens. As we mentioned at the outset of this segment, that we mentioned that when you get involved in investments, you have to be sure that you're aware of the fact that there is always the risk of loss, and it's just sad when it does actually happen, to be sure. Well, Joseph, the other story we wanted to ask about that you've had out in print and online is an update that everybody who enjoys the wonders of the Indiana Dunes National Park should be aware of. You're going to have to pay at the gate pretty soon. Tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Currently, the Indiana Dunes National Park, you know, people have been to we've lived here with it. Other national parks are a little bit different. And, you know, if you go to Smoky Mountains or you go to Arcadia or you go to Rocky Mountain, generally it's one big park that you go in and out of. And it's kind of, you know, it's fenced off. It's one big area. In some cases it might sprawl across a couple states, or like Smoky Mountains in Tennessee, North Carolina, that type of thing. But generally, it's like, one area, one big area that's fenced off. In the case of the National Dunes, obviously, it kind of spread like a ribbon across, 15 miles of lakeshore, but it's also inland. You have 25 different sites. It's all kind of different areas. You have, a lot of beaches along Lake Michigan, but you also have a lot of the inland areas. You have, Coles Bog, Pinhook Bog. You have historic sites like the Bailey Homestead, Chelberg Farm. You have the Heron Rookery, you have, all these trails and historic sites and prairies and other areas that make up part of the national park. It's just this big sprawling area across Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties, all the way from Miller out to Michigan City, where you're getting to be close to the Michigan state line. It's a very vast area encompassing hugely biodiverse area. We're talking beaches, woodlands, prairies, moraines, all kinds of different, sand dunes, bogs, just a lot of, different and varied habitats. Some of the places are very quite small. Like you go, every time I visited the Pinhook Bog, for instance, I've never seen another car in the parking lot. Usually like the only one out there hiking. There's no one, for a million miles, it feels like. They study, a couple years ago, it went from being the National Lakeshore, kind of modeled after the Cape Cod National Lakeshore in Massachusetts, to a national park. And that, it happened to be timed right with the start of the pandemic, and that really fueled a huge amount of visitation to it. It went from about 1.7 million visitors a year to 3 million visitors a year. They talked about doing entrance fees. For a long time, the only place you really had to pay to enter it was West Beach is a very popular beach at the border of Gary and Portage at, County Line Road, Lake and Porter counties. You pay generally $6 to get in for a vehicle during the summer. It was a very popular spot. It easily has the most parking of any of the beaches. And just because a lot of people are still very confused about this, the Indiana Dunes State Park is a completely different than the national park. It's surrounded by the national park on all sides. That $7 to get in, usually if you're an Indiana resident, $12 if you're from out of state, that has not changed. That will not change as a result of this. That is a state park. This is a the national park. But they are looking at imposing the fees going in. Some of it seems to be like it's basically going to be off the honor system. And they're saying if you come in and you're, it's not if you're, because a lot of people might like be kayaking on the Little Calumet River, pass through the national park, or hiking on a trail, like a lot of the trails and trails, happen to pass through the national park, but they're, you might not be spending the day there. They're saying this fee is explicitly, or these fees are explicitly for people who come to the national park, whether they're looking to hike on some of the trails or up the dunes or spend the day at the beach or whatever. But as of March 31st, they're looking to start charging, $15 per person to get in, up to $25 per family, to visit the national park daily. An annual pass to get in would be $45. They're looking at a motorcycle pass of $20, 7-day vehicle pass of $25. If you're driving in on a bus or motor coach, which is very popular, among, like, you know, there are a lot of day trips with the retirement homes or school trips or that kind of thing.
Right.
They're looking at charging about $100 for that on average. It would be, you know, a lot of the other, you know, pretty much this is pretty common. A lot of the parks you go to, Smoky Mountains, Arcadia, those types of parks, Cuyahoga, there's a fee to get in. And, the, you know, this would kind of bring it online with other national parks. There's a fee to, you know, the state park, obviously, and there has been. And, you know, honestly, the state park, you know, the state park has the fee, but it's been, you know, it's often been more, you know, they get a, it, part of it is the location, but it tends to draw bigger crowds than a lot of the, some of the national park sites just because of where it's located. And the fee hasn't been a deterrent there. But a lot of people have raised concerns just right off the bat, you know, that the fees are going to make it less accessible, particularly to locals. You have a lot of, like, you know, low-income or working-class people in the area. You know, there wouldn't worry that this is potentially going to gentrify the national park, kind of restrict it to more affluent, you know, visitors. And it's going to, you know, like, you know, it'll be off-putting to a lot of people who, you know, live in the area, but, you know, visited there for free for years, and now are being asked to drop, you know, $15 a day or whatever. The way it's priced, I mean, if you're from the area, it's kind of like a lot of the times with the museums, like the Art Institute and so forth, they'll deliberately make it so if you visit and on any kind of regular basis, it makes sense to get the annual membership rather than go per day. And certainly, if you live in Northwest Indiana and you visit the beach even a couple times per year, it would definitely be worth it the way this is structured to do the annual pass instead of to pay, you know, $50 per day to do the national park. They're saying, though, they are, you know, a lot of it would be at least 55% of the funds raised would go to maintenance, but they're looking at a lot of other expenses. They're saying the upkeep is greater. They are, you know, they're looking to fund a lot of the things like the Pensy Greenway development would be the development of the Pensy Greenway or the Marquette Greenway bike trail. I apologize. The Marquette Greenway bike trail is one big thing they're funding, but they're looking at funding, you know, visitor services, parking, transportation improvements. You know, they've got a lot of needs for that. Like Mount Baldy has been encroaching on the parking lot there at the Mount Baldy Beach near Michigan City. They're going to potentially need to find another solution to either develop a new parking lot or bring people in off-site, you know, in a couple of years, potentially. They're looking to pay for things like that to make sure the park is still, you know, sustainable. But, you know, they're talking about it needs, you know, their increased needs now for maintenance and public safety and also raising awareness of the amenities.
Well, Joseph, it looks like, Joseph, that since the fees don't officially take effect until March, there's going to be a lot of more criticism, a lot of people talking about it, to be sure, between now and then. And we certainly appreciate you talking today, bringing us up to date about the big announcement that the entrance fees are going to be imposed on the Indiana Dunes National Park. And Joseph Peets, a reporter, covers business news for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And we thank you, as always, for joining us to bring us up to date on these stories that you've put out in print and online lately. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we talk with reporters here in the region about the stories they put out in print and online. And with us today to bring us up to date in the Chesterton area, we have the editor of the Chesterton Tribune, Amy LaValle. Amy, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
And we have one story here to discuss, more of a community note, but it is of very serious interest in Porter County. It's about a vaping prevention class that is coming up at the Valparaiso YMCA.
Yes. That is from the Tobacco Education and Prevention Organization for Porter County.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like an awareness program for parents. And I know, you know, I've heard anecdotally that vaping has been an issue in the schools for quite some time. You know, it's been a long time since, you know, kids would sneak into the bathroom to smoke cigarettes, obviously. Vaping, on the other hand, there is not the residual odor, I presume. I'm not that familiar with it.
Yeah.
But so I think it is a concern. Obviously, it's illegal for anyone under 21 to purchase, like any nicotine product. Kids shouldn't be dabbling in nicotine. You know, there's better choices out there than starting to inhale things in your lungs at a young age. So, you know, hopefully they'll get the word out.
Now, has this been a real problem, at least brought a lot of public comment about at some of the school board meetings that you cover?
You know, I haven't. I've heard anecdotally from over the years from parents or here and there bits and pieces that it has been, because it is easier to conceal than, say, a pack of cigarettes and a lighter or whatever, you know, especially somewhat of the brands. The charger just looks like, you know, a USB port you might put in for the wireless mouse or something.
Yeah.
And it's really a charging device for an e-cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very small, so they're easy to conceal. You know, they're not, I think there's like a little bit of a residual odor, but it's certainly not like smoking a cigarette or other tobacco products.
And let's hope that the Valparaiso Family YMCA has some good attendance for these classes that are underway here in February, to be sure. One of the other stories you have out there that's from the Tribune and printed online is a very important story in remembrance of a very popular and very important community member in Porter County, Elka Geller Nelson. Will you tell us a little about Ms. Nelson and the type of career that she had?
Interestingly and sadly enough, she had reached out to me just about a week and a half before she passed away.
Uh-huh.
About, you know, something she was interested in my looking into. We had emailed and she copied a friend of hers on it and had said, you know, I have some medical issues coming up, so, you know, my friend can help. And, you know, a short time after that, she died. She'd had cancer for 8 years. I don't know the details of that, and that's fine. It's neither here nor there.
Mm-hmm.
She was very active in the community. Beyond just serving on different boards, she was very outspoken, I think, about different issues in the community. If she saw something that didn't sit right with her, she would speak out about it to get it addressed. And from what people have told me, that wasn't, you know, she was also very active in, you know, like state and national issues as well. And that was just her passion.
Uh-huh.
And many people respected her for it. I've talked at least privately with, you know, she was a Democrat. I've talked at least privately with, you know, Republicans really respected her, not for the story, but just who knew, you know, it wasn't for the story, but just somebody who knew her.
Right.
And found out she had passed and, you know, wanted to know what I knew. And, you know, I don't know that people necessarily always agreed with her, but they always respected her. And from what the folks I talked to said, you know, you might disagree with her even openly in public at a meeting or whatever, but then later it was fine. You know, she might unfriend you for a while on Facebook because she was mad or ticked off briefly, but that would resolve. And she just was very focused on what the things were that she wanted to see improved or taken care of.
Well, it sounds like that we'll have more, I'm sure, and you'll have more stories in the Tribune about the passing of Ms. Nelson and people remembering her as being such an important member of the community and all the causes that she spoke out against and for. So it'll be interesting to,
mm-hmm.
to find out more about mm-hmm. that. One of the other stories that you have out there, a major story from Porter County certainly, is what the County Election Board is going to be taking up when they review the proposal for voting centers in Porter County. Will you bring us up to date, I guess, first about what the voting centers are all about and what the Porter County Board of Elections and Registration will be considering soon?
So right now, if you vote early in Porter County, the 28 days before an election, depending on the nature of the election, there may be 3, possibly 5 places around the county where, regardless of where you live, early voting, you can go there and vote. Like, for example, I voted early in 2020 in the general election, drove by the county building the county administration building, which is one of the early voting centers, and the line was wrapped around the corner. I have heard just anecdotally that Union Township Fire Station, which was also one of the spots, there was never a line there. So mm-hmm. I went there, and I was in and out and back in Valpo in less time than it would have taken to wait in that line. So the concept behind the vote centers is the same. That if you live, say I live on the north side of Valparaiso, mm-hmm. my office is in Chesterton. Say I don't get a chance to vote at my local precinct polling place under the new system, I could vote at Chesterton High School on my way to work or on my way home. It wouldn't matter. There would be, part of the plan includes, well, one of the things they would have talked about doing is expanding the number of early voting locations and hours. So because that seems to be where everybody is trending, to voting not on election day, but at their convenience before that. On election day, as it stands right now, you have to vote at your precinct. Or, you know, maybe there's a school that's got four or five precincts. That's the only place you can vote on election day. So if you live in Hebron but work in Portage and have to leave at work at 5:30 in the morning before the polls open and work until 7 o'clock at night, then the polls are closed and there's nowhere along the way you could vote because you had to vote in Hebron. So what this would mean is, say you left for work at 5:30 in the morning in Hebron and you were in Portage by 6:15, you could go vote at, say, Portage High School and then go to work.
Right.
And then you'd still get to vote. It does reduce the number of polling locations from 61 to 44, which I think some people are concerned about. But they're like, wait a minute, there aren't as many places you can vote. And what officials have said, and I might add this has support, bipartisan support, both from the election board and the Democratic and Republican Party chairs. So it has bipartisan support. And what they've said is, you know, look, we're going to probably expand early voting. And also, as I just, you know, with my illustration of living in South County and working in North County, you know, you could stop along the way. It would actually make it easier for you to vote, even if there were fewer locations. Mm-hmm. And for example, there's a lot of duplicate locations. Like I said, I live on the north side of Valparaiso. My voting place is Cook's Corners Elementary School. Well, there's also several precincts that vote at Valparaiso High School, which is half a mile south of me. There's a church just south of the high school that's another polling location. And I believe there's one across Campbell Street, another church that also might be a polling location. But certainly you've got an elementary school, a high school, and a church within half a mile of each other that are all polling places. People aren't walking. They're not taking a horse and buggy. You don't need that many locations within a half mile distance of one another. So I think it'll clean up some of that.
Mm-hmm. I get the impression that, and from your story and from others that I've talked to and heard about, that this is probably a good idea because it does bring at least Porter County's election system into the 21st century.
Yes, and the majority of states in Indiana do have vote centers. I think the most recent tally I saw on the Secretary of State's website, I get emails whenever another county uh-huh. officially passes it. I think it's like 54 or something out of 92 counties are doing this. And Porter County's been talking about it for a few years. And in the past couple of years, they got new voting equipment that they don't have to buy any new equipment to do this. They have it.
Mm-hmm.
We already have it all in hand. It's all paid for.
That's
and logistically, say, in the old system, the polling equipment, say, at Portage High School for Precinct 20, I'll just make that up, mm-hmm. could only be used for those voters.
Right.
So if it stopped working or whatever, there was an issue, somebody had to program the voting equipment and then bring it out there and take the time to program it or whatever. But now all the equipment that would be used at all the locations could accept voters from any location. So everything, you don't have to program all the machines differently. It doesn't matter.
I know that your story also covers when the election board is going to take up this proposal. They probably want to vote very soon on this, and it has to go on for further approval. So there is a very real possibility that if all the approval comes in time, that the voting centers could be set up in time for the May 3rd primary election.
I believe that is the goal. The election board has to approve it unanimously. They gave preliminary approval to go forward. They held three public meetings about it. They voted at the meeting last week to, open up the public comment period. There's like links on the county website. People can mail letters in or drop them off or whatever. There's a link, on the voter and registration Facebook page. So they have a 30-day comment period. And then after that, the election board at the February 18th meeting plans on giving it final approval. And from there, the county commissioners and the county council meet February 22nd. And both of those boards also must approve it. Mm-hmm. Now, like I said, the election board, it has to be all five of them. With the commissioners and the council, they need a simple majority of those boards. So two out of the three commissioners and four of the seven council members. And if they get all that organized, then they can go forward May 3rd primary.
Well, and we know that the folks at the election board and registration office are ready for this. They've worked out all the details and hope to have things ready to go so that if the approval makes it official, that it'll be up for voters to be able to take advantage of here before the primary elections. Well, Amy, thank you for this great story and for the others that you've been able to talk to us about today. And we hope to have you back on again soon.
All right. Thank you. It was great talking to you.
It's great talking with you. Amy LaValle is the editor of the Chesterton Tribune, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. There are more youngsters than you realize that because of the pandemic have not gotten their regular shots, which in turn any other time would protect them from very serious illnesses. So there's going to be a special event coming up on February 19th in the city of Gary to try to resolve that. And with us to talk about what is being called Back on Track, we have with us LaTanya Woodson. She's the Director of Community Health Education with Edgewater Health. And also from Edgewater Health, we have the Chief Medical Officer, who just happens to be the City of Gary's Health Commissioner, Dr. Roland Walker. He's a pediatrician. And thank you both for being with us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Thank you for having us, sir.
Thank you. Yes.
Tell us first, if you will, Dr. Walker, how the city of Gary seems to stand these days with having young people try to get their shots. We have enough concerns about COVID-19 and for those who are eligible to get vaccine, for them to be vaccinated. But how about all the regular things, and you're aware of just from your daily practice as a pediatrician, that young people have to have either before they go to school or while they're in school?
So it sets up an interesting challenge for us, right? Because people are less likely to come out and go to places where there's going to be a gathering, whether it be a medical office or any other type of entertainment. So when they come to the medical office, it's really important that not only that they get their vaccinations, but they get their health maintenance checks. Because for pediatric population, it's really important that we are establishing, how a child is doing psychosocially, developmentally, physical development, emotional development, educational development. So all of those things during a pandemic are blunted, right? And so with that, the immunization rate, pediatric immunization rate, has fallen a bit, particularly in the inner city during the pandemic time.
Mm-hmm. I know that the State Department of Health has the records that they get for all the school districts on these topics, and I understand that for the Gary Community Schools in particular, they have listed that 53% of the K-12 students in the school district have not received all their required shots, and that's That's more than double of, or almost double, what the statewide average is, which is just about 26% of K through 12 students that don't have all their regular shots. So I can see it's especially important within the city of Gary to be able to make sure that all the youngsters do. But are you hoping as well that this Back on Track event coming up on February 19th will bring in some other youngsters from some of the other surrounding school districts as well?
Well, so first of all, as health commissioner, let me just say that 26% statewide is way too high. I know the statistic has been given 53% in Gary. I'm not exactly sure how accurate that is. I know in my office we work really hard to make sure the kids get their shots.
Yeah.
We do a lot of calls. But whatever the number it is way too high. We are definitely going to welcome people from other school districts, other areas. The goal, no matter where a kid is from, to make sure that they are properly immunized. And then also this helps us educate the public as a whole, right? Now, we're doing this time where everybody talks about vaccine mandates. I never use that word. I always use vaccine requirements, which has been something that we've done almost since the beginning of time. We have a lot of information about all vaccines, including COVID. But these are similar arguments you heard about polio, right? And now you don't have these iron lung wars you used to see back in the 40s and 50s. You just don't see that anymore. As people get more educated and become more comfortable, they vaccinate. What I found is that people are more likely to vaccinate their children than they are to vaccinate themselves. And a lot of that just has to do with people's own, even if it's adult, their fear in vaccinations. But because of those vaccination requirements for schools, it's more likely that the children receive those vaccinations. We see that as an opportunity also to screen for those other things. That's why at this event, it's more than just a vaccination event. It was very, very important to me that we also be able to give health maintenance visits at this time. And so we're offering a lot of things to make sure that we can screen for health maintenance visits. We're doing COVID testing. We're doing COVID vaccination. We're doing childhood vaccinations. And then we're going to have lots of little things to entice people to come so that we can assess where they are in their immunization status. Mm-hmm. And try and service them as best as possible.
Well, Tanya, if you will, tell us how things are getting set up here within the Edgewater Health Organization to get ready for this big Back on Track event.
Yes, here at Edgewater, our CEO and president, Dr. Danita Johnson Hughes, we are all here waiting, and we are planning a huge team that will be here on Saturday, February the 19th, beginning at 11 o'clock to 2 o'clock. Mm-hmm. The pre-registration form is up on our website. You can visit our website at edgewaterhealth.org to complete the registration form. We encourage that so that we'll know exactly how many people will be attending, but of course, if you're ready to come on the day of, we welcome you. We'd like to also thank our partners, which is MD Wise, who is the funding sponsor for this event, the Walker Medical Center, Indiana Department of Health, and of course, we're going to have other things that we're going to be that's going to be occurring for that day. So we're really, really, really excited for Saturday, February the 19th.
Now, besides the opportunity for the young people to come in and get the shots that they need to get caught up, what other things are going to be available for them and for their family members at the event?
So, again, as Dr. Walker indicated, the goal of the vaccination and wellness event is to give school-aged children and their parents the opportunity to receive the COVID-19 vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
While there, they will have the opportunity to receive COVID-19 booster shots, rapid testing, blood pressure checks, and to also speak with a clinical representative regarding any questions or concerns they may have with their children receiving the COVID-19 vaccination.
Dr. Walker, since you have the opportunity by being the chief medical officer of Edgewater Health to be able to help set things up like this, do you find that this has become easier, certainly, in your role as the City of Gary's health commissioner?
One of the things I like to do is make sure that people are working in collaboration. So MDY's contacted me about 2 months ago on this issue in my capacity as health commissioner. And so the city of Gary was ready immediately to step out and provide vaccinations, pediatric vaccinations and the adult vaccinations for COVID for this event. Edgewater is the perfect place in terms of location in the city of Gary and space to host this event. So we thought that that was a great marriage. So I'm very appreciative to the Gary Health Department who will be providing the immunization. The mayor, Jerome Prince, greatly appreciative to him for supporting this event. Very appreciative to Dr. Danita Hughes and Edgewater for hosting this event. And then all the employees at Walker Medical who will be providing the health maintenance and helping along with the immunizations. The event. So it's a great marriage of a lot of different organizations. As well as now, as of yesterday, I was also speaking with WDS, who wants to come and provide some services, and that is Denise Dillard, one of the people in our community that does a lot of work, so appreciative to her as well.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Now, LaTanya, let me ask you, you mentioned here about the fact that folks can, they're encouraged to register for the event. They don't have to. They can show up. If they do show up, if their families show up, are there any things in particular that they need to bring if they come to the event coming up on the 19th?
We're just asking that everyone will wear a mask just for safety purposes. But no, we will make sure that everything is taken care of. Again, if you would like to register, pre-register, you will go ahead to edgewaterhealth.org, or you may call 219-885-4264, extension 4704, and someone will be there to answer your phone call.
That's great.
Again, Edgewater Health is located 1100 West 6th Avenue, right here in Gary, Indiana. So, yes, we are looking forward to serving the public on that day.
May I add something? And
yes.
That is, if you have the child's immunization record, to please bring that. Now, if you don't have it, that doesn't mean don't come. But
yeah.
If you have it, please bring it, because not only will that speed up the process, but particularly now, we service a lot of people from Illinois and Indiana. So we have a lot of kids that are coming over from Chicago, and so it makes it a little bit more difficult to obtain their immunization records. So we ask if you have a copy to please bring that with you. That will help up the process, and it'll be better for your child.
Now, I know, too, there will be some individuals and certainly maybe some family members that might need some help in getting to the event. They need some help with transportation. How can they get some help?
Well, a letter is being sent to the local churches asking pastors to assist us with van transportation.
That's great.
So a letter is going out to the faith-based community, and we're looking forward to receiving some responses back pertaining to that.
Also, Gary Transportation Corporation has always been a great partner. So that'll be something, you know, this is fluid. We'll reach out to them as well, because they've always been a great partner for events like this.
That's great to hear. It sounds like that everybody is just about ready to get ready for the Back on Track event coming up on Saturday, February 19th. That's going to be happening at the Edgewater Health Operation, which is once again located in Gary. And we have with us to talk about it two representatives, actually, from Edgewater Health. We have the chief medical officer, who happens to be the City of Gary Health Commissioner, Dr. Roland Walker, and LaTanya Woodson, who is the director of community health education for Edgewater Health. Thank you very much for being with us to give us great information. We hope a lot of people are taking advantage of this opportunity to make sure their youngsters are properly vaccinated as they would normally would be, usually sometime in the summer, I'm sure, before the start of school year, but not this time around. They haven't gotten it because, of course, the pandemic has gotten in the way, but they're hopefully going to try and catch up. Thank you both for being with us to talk about this today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. Our thanks to Joseph Pete with the Times of Northwest Indiana, Chesterton Tribune editor Amy LaValle for their stories on Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and to Dr. Roland Walker and LaTanya Woodson with Edgewater Health telling us about the upcoming Back on Track immunization vaccination event. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back with you on Monday.